Right. He laughed and his eyes crinkled. The plan is to do the deed when she returns, if she hasn't come to her senses by then. He laughed again, looking past the rim of his glass. I'll be the one wearing white. And Dr. Turvey? He'll be there, I suppose. Yes. He's promised to give away the bride. Chapter 43. I trained Rack in a fever. The St. Ledger was in early August. There were only a few precious months left to get him on top form. And then the worst happened. Rack's recent successes should have made Ogilvy feel confident in his horse, but his friends had begun to whisper to him. How could he trust a girl to bring Rack into his sharpest glory? For any old race at Nakuru, certainly, but for the St. Ledger? Did he really want to risk it? And so it was that less than 3 months before the race of my life, I had no horse. I could barely think or see straight. In the year I'd had Rack, I'd put everything into him. His skill and prowess and moments of glory were me, mine, with my stamp on every reach and thundering turn. Now his loss had left me nothing. I was hollowed out. What will we do? I asked Ruta. We were sitting on hay bales up in the stands, the sun and the day's labours gone. Velvet night pushed in, soft and deadly. We still have half a dozen horses to run at the meeting. In the smaller races, yes. I know we can take some of those, but for the classic, the one race that matters? We must think on this, he said, looking out at the night. There is much we don't yet know. All the other owners will see that Ogilvy has pulled Rack. And if he wins anyway, without us, they'll clap him on the back, saying how clever he was, how forward-looking. I sighed and stewed, tugging at my hair, until Ruta left for home and his wife. When I was alone again, I listened to the pulsing thrum of insects and the more distant noises of the stable, knowing that if Dennis were anywhere on the continent, anywhere at all, I would have run to him. Just to feel his arms around me, to feel centered there, and know I could go on somehow, finding strength and courage along the way. But he wasn't. He was nowhere I could find him. A few days later, Ruta was out on breezes with Melton Pye when Eric Gooch came into the stable. He was an owner I didn't know very well, tall and nervous-looking, with a tick of straightening his tie every few minutes. I was familiar with one of his fillies, though. Wise Child was out of one of my father's best broodmares, Ask Papa. Like Pegasus, she'd been delivered into my hands, a bundle of slick warmth and promise. She had the right blood in her to be a serious contender for prize money. But early on, another trainer had run her too hard. Her fragile tendons had been jarred severely on the wrong sort of track, concussing them. Now, no matter how perfect her pedigree was, she could barely carry a rider.
Her legs could be built back up again, Eric said, with the right care.
Maybe they could, I agreed, but in 12 weeks?
She's a fighter, and I don't know.
He straightened his tie again, while above it his Adam's apple bobbed preposterously.
I have a hunch you'd know what to do with her.
He was referring to my success years before with Dee's horse, Ringleader, who'd had a similar injury. I'd trained him on the shores of El Mentata, and he'd come back to run and win. But there hadn't been the urgency then, and my career wasn't at stake. I don't want to make crazy promises, I said. The truth is, she might never live up to her potential now, let alone win classics. But the chance is there.
You'll take her then?
I'll try. It's all I can do.
The next day, Wise Child came to us, with her soft, lovely muzzle, and her fighter's spirit, and those legs that nearly broke my heart. She'd been done terrible wrong, and needed painstaking care now. Over the next 12 weeks, we couldn't make the smallest mistake with her. Like Elmendata, Lake Nakuru had a rich and muddy fringe at its edge, which gave well. That's where we brought Wise Child to run her paces. Sometimes Ruta rode her, and sometimes I did, easing her from a trot to a canter to a gallop. A rose-pink tide of flamingos startled around us, making their wooden sound. Tens of thousands of birds climbed as one, and then receded, settling with a clamor, only to startle again. They became our timekeepers. They alone saw a kind of magic begin to happen as Wise Child grew stronger and surer of herself. She had been wounded, nearly broken. You could still see her fear each morning as she tested those first few steps gingerly, as if the mud might hold knives. But she had a warrior's courage. When she opened up now, we could see trust and willingness in her, and something more than speed. "This muscle," Ruta said in her stall, as he groomed her silky and compact bay body. "This muscle can move a mountain." "I think you're right, Ruta, but it also scares me. She's in top shape. She'll never be more ready. But even so, it would take almost nothing for those legs to fail. It could happen on race day. It could happen tomorrow." Ruta continued his grooming, the dandy brush skimming her gleaming, liquid-looking coat. "All this is true, but God is inside her. Her heart is like a spear, like a leopard." I smiled at him. "Which one is it, Ruta? A spear or a leopard? You know, sometimes you sound just like you did when we were children, boasting how much higher you could jump than me." "I still can jump, Beru," he laughed. "Even today." "I believe you, my friend. Have I told you lately how very glad I am that you're here?" I knew Ruta and I would be together always, until the very end. But no matter how close loyalty, or God, or magic crept into the weeks we trained Wise Child, human frailty and fear were stronger. 3 days before the race, Eric came to see me. His wife had seen our heads pressed a little too close together at the club one evening, talking of Wise Child and her possibilities. And now she had given him an ultimatum. "It's you or her," he said, in a near strangled way, clutching at that tie until I wanted to rip it from his neck.
"But there's nothing going on between us. Can't you tell her that?"
"It won't matter. She's got to mean more than the horse, or anything else."
"Don't be stupid. We're nearly there. Pull her after the race if you must."
He shook his head, swallowing.
"You don't know my wife."
"This is going to ruin me, Eric. I've killed myself for your horse. This is my race. You damn well know you owe me that."
He went red to the tips of his ears, and then slunk away like a coward, muttering words of remorse. When Sonny Bumpus came with a groom later that morning to take Wise Child, I was beside myself. I'd used Sonny as a jockey before, and we'd known each other since we were children, all the way back to my terrible years at boarding school in town. We'd lined up desks to play at steeplechasing then. Now he was one of the best riders in the colony, and it didn't take much work to guess that Eric had asked him to ride Wise Child, and that both Sonny and my horse were being handed cleanly over to the new trainer.
"Tell me why this is happening, Sonny. You know how hard I've worked."
"It's the worst sort of shame, Beryl. If I had any choice, I wouldn't take her. I was all set to ride Rack, but now he's broken down.
He'll run again, but not this time.
Rack's out?
For now, yes.
Then Wise Child's sure to win. God damn it, Sonny! I have to have this!
I don't know what to say, kid. Gooch isn't likely to change his mind. He pressed his teeth together hard, making the muscles in his jaw jump. I'll tell you one thing, though. Everyone on the track will know what's what. You've done the work with her. All I'm getting is the ride.
When he'd gone, I stared at the wall, my heart shuddering in place. There had been times in my life when I might have deserved this sort of comeuppance. I couldn't pretend otherwise. Eric's wife had no doubt heard an earful of gossip about me, but I hadn't so much as put a finger on him. I had worried over Wise Child, nurtured and babied her, loved her. Now she'd been taken from my stables, my hands. Not even Rooter could talk to me.
Chapter 44. At the post, 10 horses ripple and stamp. Their jockeys light, brilliant as feathers. They're poised to run, dying to run, and when the starter gives his signal, they do. Rooter stands behind me in Delamere's box. We both feel Wise Child in the field, quivering like music. Every horse is glorious. Each has a story and a magnificent will, blood and muscle, clean legs and flying tail. But none of them is like her. They, none of them, have her strength. Sonny knows how to get everything from our filly, but little by little, one pulsing beat at a time. He intuits when to coax her or hold her back, or inch her into a waiting, almost infinitesimal gap. She has speed and smoothness, and a reserve of something else, something undefined. But will it be enough? Soon everyone in the grandstand comes to their feet, craning to see bits of coloured silk above churning legs, the stakes high or negligible. None of that matters. The money is an afterthought, something to play at, shells on a table. The horses, though, the horses live, and Wise Child is more soulful and alive than she has ever been or ever will be. She gains on a black stallion, then a chestnut, and a creamy filly. Flank and rail, shadow and silky animal grace. At the final turn she has the lead, a nose at first, then a body length, two. Rooter puts a hand on my shoulder. My stomach leaps into my throat, my ears. There isn't a sound in the crowd of thousands, none that I can hear. Somewhere Eric Gooch is watching with his wife, dying a little to see his horse in front. But he won't see what I see. No one knows what to look for except me and Rooter and Sonny. How Wise Child lists from the rail. A snag, a falter, a flickering sway that amounts to less than a fraction of a moment. Her legs are going. They've done all they can for her. The field closes on her as I lurch backwards into Rooter's chest. I feel his steady drumming heart with my whole body, the beating of a long-ago Ngoma, the pounding of Arap Maina's fist against the taut hide of his shield. And that's how I can bear the rest of it, when I want to cry and scream and go to her, stopping the race. Everything. Can't the world see that she's thrown all of herself on that track, and that it isn't enough? Then, somehow, from a place beyond sense or strategy, she breaks forward, unpinned from her body's flaws and marvels. It's only courage that takes her the final distance. Only grit. When her muzzle hits the tape, the crowd releases the flare of a single collective cheer. Even the losers have triumphed with her, for she has shown them something more than a race. There is a bright blur of thrown tickets, bodies crowding the rails and gate. The band begins to play. Only Rooter and I are still. Our girl has done more than win. With those legs, with not much more than her heart, She's broken the St. Ledger record. Chapter 45. Even when he was very old, and horses were behind him, and Africa too, Sonny Bumpus would keep a silver cigarette case in his pocket that I'd engraved for him with Wise Child's name and the date of our St. Ledger. He was fond of taking it out and stroking the warm and gleaming top with his thumb, ready to tell anyone who would listen about the ride of his life and how I'd brought back Wise Child from a near-crippled state to produce one of the greatest victories in the history of racing. Sonny was a good egg. He had had that moment of perfect flight, but he gave the greater part of the glory to me. And though Eric Gooch never came crawling to give Wise Child back, or even thank me, most of the colony was ready to praise my accomplishments. Later that season, Ruta and I had a string of validating wins. Welsh Guard triumphed at Elderette, Melton Pie took the Christmas handicap, and our own Pegasus won gold at 3 Gymkhanas running. In February, I began to train Dovedale, a horse of Ben Birkbeck's, and when I met him at Dee's Hotel in Nakuru to talk over our strategy, Ginger Mayo was on his arm. I hadn't seen very much of her since Karen's shooting party, but she looked lovely and content now, her bright red hair pulled back on one side with a jeweled clip, her pale skin flawless. On her left hand sat a fat pearl ring. Apparently she and Ben were engaged. She'd made quick work of it, too. His divorce from Cocky had been finalized only months before. "The wedding will be here, at the hotel," Ginger said, tapping her fingertips on her collarbone, just above the teal silk collar of her dress. I shouldn't have been surprised by any of it. Colony life was so small and confined. The same people kept popping up in different combinations. Of course Ginger was marrying Ben. Who else was there, after all? But if I'd ever had any patience for the way things worked here, I was losing it. It was like watching fortune's wheel spinning over and over, spilling bodies that struggled to climb on again, clinging for dear life. I had done my fair share of falling, and I felt exhausted now. I also wasn't entirely myself. The weather had been so dry lately that it had got into my throat, stinging whenever I swallowed. My ears felt as if they were padded with searing cotton. My eyes burned. "You should see my doctor in Nairobi," Ginger insisted later. "Nonsense," I told her. "I'll be all right when it rains again." "You work for me now," she laughed, only pretending to be serious. "Just promise me you'll see him." By the time I got to Nairobi, fever had taken me over. I shook with chills, wondering if malaria had finally got its hooks into me, or typhus, or blackwater fever, or any of the other deathly ailments that had plagued settlers in Kenya for 50 years. Ginger's doctor wanted to plunge me into an ice bath straight away. Apparently, I had tonsillitis, and he wanted to operate. "I don't like doctors," I told him, reaching for my jacket. "I'll keep my own blood, thank you very much." "The infection's not going away. You'll go septic if you keep this up. You wouldn't want to be the girl who died from bum tonsils, would you?" And so he operated. I fought only a little as the paper cone, soaked with ether, was pushed over my nose. Everything spun and hollowed with blackness. And when I finally came to again, climbing into consciousness as through a dense fog, I saw Dennis's familiar face, the light through spotty shades making a smeary sort of halo around him. "You're back," I croaked. He patted his own throat, pantomiming that I shouldn't try to speak. "Ginger made me swear to come and see you. I think she was worried her doctor might do you in." He smiled ruefully. "Glad to see he didn't,
Behind him, a nurse in a prim, tri-cornered hat, fussed with another patient's bedding. I wished she would go away and leave us alone. I wanted to ask how he'd been, and if he'd missed me, and what would happen now. As it was, I could barely swallow. "Tanya would have come, but she hasn't been well," he said. "The farm is desperate. And she's been so low, I'm afraid she might hurt herself." He saw my eyes widen and explained. "She's threatened it before. Her father went that way, you know." He paused, thinking, and I could see how he struggled with every word. Dennis didn't easily discuss matters of the heart, and then there was the complex puzzle of connection between us three. He clearly didn't want to be speaking of Karen with me, and yet I was deeply involved on both sides. "I've arranged for a neighbor, Ingrid Lindstrom, to stay with her when I go away on safari," he went on. "Tanya shouldn't be alone now, and she shouldn't worry about anything."
"She can't know about us,"
I risked a whisper.
"I understand that."
Of course I did. He looked away to where the shadow of my bed rails stood sketched on the bumpy wall. The dark, slanted lines were like the bars of a prison cell.
"I never seem to know what to say to you, Beryl." "This is goodbye, then."
"For now." I closed my eyes, feeling the tendrils of exhaustion wanting to pull me under into medicine-thick sleep. I had always known I couldn't have Dennis. He wasn't for having. His spirit was too free for that. I understood that too well, and yet I'd believed we could go on as we had, stealing what time we could, living each marvelous moment as it came. But that was finished. It had to be.
"Beryl,"
I heard him say, but I didn't answer. When I awoke again later, the room was dark, and he was gone. Ginger picked me up the next week and drove me back to my lodgings in Nakuru so I wouldn't have to suffer the train. My throat ached, and my encounter with Dennis had left me saddened and raw. Whether or not he married Karen, the bond they had was too complicated and too gripping for either of them ever to separate. Somehow, I would have to find a way to wish them happiness. I did care for them both, as confusing as that was.
"You're still not up to snuff, are you?"
Ginger asked. I'd been quiet, watching the road rise and fall in front of the car, the wheels dipping into ruts so deep they sometimes made my teeth jar.
"I shouldn't get involved,"
she went on delicately. "Dennis is such a lovable person, isn't he?" I looked at her slantwise, wondering what she might know, and from what source.
"We're good friends, of course."
"He tries so hard with Tanya." She clenched the wheel with pale yellow kidskin gloves. "But I'm not sure he can really put anyone else at the center." Frankly, Ginger was surprising me. I had only ever heard her chatter about shallow things, lace and waistlines, engagements and puddings. I preferred this real talk.
"Many people can't," I said. "Does love really have to look one way for it to count?"
"You're far more understanding of the whole thing than I'd ever be."
"Really? You and Ben haven't exactly had a conventional courtship?"
I swallowed and felt small knives, wishing I had ice or chilled custard for my throat, or that the dust would settle.
"I'm sorry. I don't mean to be a bitch. I really do wish you two the best."
"It's all right." I waited a long time for him, without knowing if he would ever be free. "Is that stupidity or courage?"
"I don't know," I told her. "Maybe it's both."
Chapter 46. After Ginger and Ben were married, she began to play hostess at their farm, Mgunga, and seemed particularly keen on new guests or visitors to Africa. She loved to throw dinner parties, always perfect in a silk frock with a string of pearls that nearly swept her knees. I had a few things I could dust off for polite company, but generally wore slacks instead, and a crisp man's shirt. That's what I chose for a dinner party she threw in June, thinking more about how odd it was to be invited back to Njoro as a guest. Their property was less than a mile from Green Hills, and as I traced the familiar road in my new car, nostalgia rose up to meet me. Little had changed, and also everything. Sir Charles and Mansfield Markham were brothers. They had come to Kenya looking for a winter home for their well-to-do mother, who'd had her fill of London's icy damp. They'd found a suitable villa very nearby in the Rongai Valley, which was where Ginger had stumbled on them. Once she'd finished fating them properly, they were going to go off on safari, hunting elephant with Blix. Mansfield was 22, well-shaved and genteel. His skin was as smooth as butter, his hands milky, without the slightest sign of wear. At dinner I noticed him watching me, while his brother seemed distracted by the full platter of gazelle steaks. I didn't have the heart to tell Charles there was little variety here, and that he'd likely be eating nothing else for months and months. "My people are from Nottinghamshire," Mansfield told me, his trimmed nails tracing the heavy base of his water glass. "Like Robin Hood."
"You don't look very swashbuckling."
"No,
I keep trying."
He smiled and his nice teeth showed. "Ginger tells me you train horses. That's unusual."
"Is that a polite way of saying masculine?"
No, he blushed. Later I found myself facing him over brandy in the low, broad sitting room, where he began to explain what he had said before. "I'm not all that masculine myself, actually. When I was a boy, I was sickly and spent too much time with the gardener, learning the Latin names of plants. I garden for sport. My mother gives me sets of white handkerchiefs at Christmas, when she gives Charles rifles."
"Handkerchiefs are useful."
"Yes." His eyes crinkled. "Though perhaps not in Kenya."
"What would you choose instead?"
"For myself?
I don't know.
Maybe what you all have here? This is marvelous country. I have a feeling it could bring out the best in anyone."
"I've never wanted to be anywhere else. I grew up just the other side of the hill. My father had the most wonderful horse farm. It was my whole life."
"What happened to it?"
"Money trouble. It's crass to talk about such things, though, isn't it?"
"It's real. That's my feeling."
I didn't know what it was about Mansfield that put me at ease, but before long I found myself telling him a story about how once an enraged stallion had attacked Wee McGregor while I sat atop him. The two of them had gone at it as if I didn't exist. It seemed like a matter of life or death, and then, just as suddenly, they backed away from each other.
"Weren't you afraid?"
"Of course, but also fascinated. I felt as if I was witnessing something private and rare. The animals had forgotten about me."
"You're much closer to Robin Hood than I am, aren't you?" he asked, after listening keenly.
"Would white handkerchiefs save me?"
"I hope not."
The next day, when the Markham brothers had gone off to join Blix, I drove to Nairobi for a few days to take care of some business. I'd arranged to stay at the club, and returned there that first night to find Mansfield at the bar with the best bottle of wine he could find.
"There you are,"
he said, clearly relieved. I thought I'd missed you.
I thought you were off to find Elephant.
I was. But we only got as far as Campi Yimoto before I told Blix to turn the lorry round. I had to see about a girl.
I felt myself flush.
Did you read that in a book?
Sorry.
I don't mean to be presumptuous.
I just couldn't stop thinking about you.
Do you have other plans for dinner?
I should lie and say I do. That would teach you.
It might, he smiled, or I might hang around for another day and ask you again.
Presumptuous as he was, I found myself liking Mansfield. He set us up in the darkest corner of the dining room, and as the courses came and went, he refilled my glass before it was half empty, and leaned over to light my cigarette as soon as I thought to reach for one. His solicitousness reminded me of Frank, but he didn't have a whit of Frank's coarseness.
I loved your stories from the other night. I think I would have been another person entirely if I'd grown up here, as you did.
What was the matter with your lot?
I was too coddled, for one thing.
Too cared for, if that makes any sense.
I nodded. I've thought sometimes that being loved a little less than others can actually make a person, rather than ruin them.
I can hardly imagine someone not loving you.
When I move to Kenya, we're going to be great friends.
What? You'll pick up and settle here, just like that?
Why not? I've been drifting for years, wondering what on earth to do with my inheritance. This seems such a clear direction.
The word inheritance seemed to flutter over the table.
I've never known how to handle money, I told him. I'm not sure I understand it.
Nor do I. Maybe that's why it sticks to me like glue.
I picked up my brandy and rolled the globe of the glass in my palms. Only trouble sticks to me with any regularity. But I'm learning to think that can shape a person too.
You're going to force me to say it, aren't you?
What?
That you have a wonderful shape.
After dinner, he trailed me to the veranda and lit my cigarette with a heavy silver lighter that bore his initials, M.M., in a deeply stamped scroll. This was obviously part of the spoils of being a Markham from Nottinghamshire. But I could tell he'd grown up with beauty, too, and culture. He had perfect manners and the kind of optimism that came when you knew that if life didn't go exactly your way one moment, you could change its mind the next. As he bent to light his own cigarette, I watched the smooth movement of his hands, feeling there was something awfully familiar about him. Then it struck me. It was Barclay he reminded me of, in his compactness and dark, slim composure, his easy, cultured manner. They were cut from the same cloth. He looked up.
What?
Nothing. You have lovely hands.
Do I?
He smiled. Beyond the pink terrace, the veranda flared out, flat and cool and dark. Fireflies skimmed its surface with plaintive, flickering pulses of desire. I love it so much here. It's one of my special places.
I have a room, he said, looking not at me, but at the winking tip of his cigarette.
It's the most charming thing you've ever seen. A separate little bungalow with someone's nice books everywhere and a table made of ivory tusks.
Would you like to come for a nightcap?
Dennis's cottage. He was never there anymore, but it made my throat tighten to think the place could belong to anyone else, even for a night.
That's sweet of you, but I'm afraid I have to say no.
At least for now.
I'm being presumptuous again, aren't I?
Maybe so, I told him. Sleep well.
The next afternoon, Markham asked me to ride out to Njoro with him by car.
"The roads are terrible," I warned him. "It will take all day."
"Even better, then." He didn't lose his sunny quality, even when one of the tires on the auto blew out on the road with a sharp report, loud as a shotgun. It clearly never changed a tire, so I did it while he watched, as amazed as if I'd pulled the spare from my pocket instead of the boot.
"You're a remarkable woman," he said. "It's really quite easy."
I poked around for something to wipe my grimy hands on, and finally had to settle for the knees of my slacks.
"Honestly, Beryl, I've never met anyone like you."
"It makes me want to do something rash."
"Like learn to change a tire?" I teased.
"Like buy a farm for you."
"What? You've got to be joking."
"Not at all. We should all get back what we've lost if we can. And anyway, it wouldn't only be for you. I'd love to have that sort of life."
"We've only just met."
"I told you I was feeling rash," he said. "But I should also warn you, I'm quite serious. I'm not the sort of fellow who minces around when he sees something he wants." We got back into the car and drove for several miles more in silence. I didn't know what to make of what he'd said, and that soon became obvious. "I've made you uncomfortable," he said after a while. "Please don't misunderstand. I really am flattered."
"And yet?"
He smiled sideways at me from behind the wheel. "I feel a large qualification coming. I've a special sense for them. I'm just a very proud person. No matter how much I'd love to have a farm like Green Hills, I couldn't accept such a large gift from you, or from anyone."
"I'm proud too," he said, "and stubborn as well. But it seems obvious to me that we want the same thing. We could be partners in a grand venture, equally independent, equally stubborn partners."
I had to smile at that, but didn't say anything more until we came to Kampi Yamoto Station and began to climb the steep grade. There wasn't anything left of our farm but a few now derelict outbuildings and listing paddock fences, but the view from our hill was the same.
"It's so lovely," he said, stopping the car and shutting off the motor. "And all this was yours?"
There were my abadares, unfurled and blue against the fresher, paler blue of the sky, and the sharp lip of the Menengai crater, and the darkly fringed Mao forest, humming with life. Even the ruin of my father's old house didn't make me sad when I took in everything else. "Yes, it was."
"Oh, I nearly forgot,"
Mansfield said suddenly. He stretched behind him and pulled out an ice bucket he'd hidden well, wedging it against the rear seat. It was half full of tepid water, and the curving bottle that had lost any hope of chilling long before.
"It'll probably be terrible now," he said as he popped the cork.
"It doesn't matter," I told him. "A dear friend once told me that champagne is absolutely compulsory in Kenya. You must belong here after all."
"You see, then?"
He poured for us into the simple glasses he'd brought along. "What shall we toast?" I looked past him, through the window glass at the view that had forever been stitched into my heart. I'll never forget this place, you know, even if one day it forgets me. "I'm glad you wanted to come. Green Hills is a lovely name. What shall we call our farm?"
"You're going to keep at it until you wear me down, aren't you?"
"That's the plan, yes." I looked at him, so like Barclay, with his fine smooth hands and his beautiful haircut, and suddenly had a strong urge to kiss him. When I did, his lips were feather soft. His tongue tasted like champagne. Chapter 47. True to his word, over the next few months, Mansfield wore down my doubts and my defences, little by little. The farm was one thing. I had always longed for a way to replace Green Hills, in my mind and heart, after all. But soon I realized he was set on marrying me. My divorce from Jock has only just come through. You can't really think I'm mad enough to try matrimony again. Everything will be different, he assured me. We're different. Mansfield did seem to be a rare sort of man. He was nothing like Jock or Frank or Boy Long, and also listened to every tale about my thorny past without batting an eyelash. I'd decided not to keep a single thing from him, not even about Dennis and Karen. I couldn't if our relationship was going to have a prayer. That much I'd learned, and painfully. Are you still in love with Dennis? He had wanted to know. He chose Karen. There's nothing I can do to change that. I watched a small cloud pass over Mansfield's expression and his mood. Are you sure you want to get involved with me? My heart's always been restless, and I can't promise I'll be good at any of the dull stuff, the cooking and whatnot.
I could have guessed that part, he smiled.
I'm looking for a companion, as much as a lover. Life has been awfully lonely at times. Tell me, do you like me, Beryl?
I do. Honestly, I like you so much.
I like you, too. And that's where we'll begin. We married 4 months after Ginger introduced us, in September of 1927. My bouquet was a cluster of lilies and white carnations, which Karen helped select as a gift. But the choice of my dress was mine, a slim crepe de chine, with sleeves that clung to my arms, and a long silver fringe that lay over the skirt, like a net of stars. I'd cut my hair for the day in a tightly cropped shingle I had done on impulse, liking immediately how free and cool my neck felt without the weight. Dee stood in for my father to give me away and cried doing it, dabbing at his face with damp sleeves. Afterwards, there was a fine lunch at the Mutega, and through it all I tried not to linger over long on thoughts of Dennis. He was off in Tsavo, then Uganda. I had cabled him with an invitation and got no response. I wanted to believe it was jealousy that kept him silent and absent, but it was just as likely that my news hadn't reached him at all. I put my horses on the ease list, said goodbye to Ruta, and we then left for several months' honeymoon in Europe. In Rome we stayed near the Spanish Steps, at the Hassler Hotel, which looked like a 19th-century palace to me. Our bed was enormous and draped with gold velvet. The bathtub was Italian marble. The parquet floors had been polished to shine like mirrors. I couldn't stop wanting to pinch myself to see if it was all some sort of dream.
The George V in Paris is even finer, Mansfield said.
When we were there, and I stood gaping at our private view of the Eiffel Tower and the Champs-Élysées, he said I should wait until I'd seen Claridge's in London. He was right about that, too. We arrived in Mansfield's Rolls-Royce, a car beautiful enough to get all the doormen hopping. The attention and the gleaming marble, the vases full of flowers and the draping silk, helped to dispel the ghost of my previous trip to London, and how knocked sideways I'd been. This wasn't that. Whenever I started to drift and the past came back too clearly, I watched the trail of our Louis Vuitton trunks. We had escargot in Paris, choucroute garnie with sprigs of fresh rosemary, spaghetti with mussels and black squid ink in Rome. Even better than the meals were the cultural highlights in every city, the opera, the architecture, the views, and the museums. And with every new sight or incomparable view, when I thought,
Dennis should be here. I tried to ignore that voice. It was disloyal, for a start, and also impossible. Dennis had made his choice, and I'd made mine. And Mansfield was a good man. I respected and admired him through and through, and if the love I felt for him wasn't exactly the kind that could send me over the top of a mountain on horseback in the middle of the night, it was quietly solid. He stayed by my side. He held my hand and kissed me over and over, saying, "I'm so happy we've found each other. I can hardly believe it's real." Mansfield had always been close to his mother, a relationship I was trying to understand. But how could I, really? He was keen for her to like me, and thought it important that we get off on the right foot. "She'll have certain expectations of what you're supposed to be," he told me. "What do you mean?" "Africa is Africa. When we've finished here, we can hide away and behave however we like. But Mother and her friends aren't very advanced in their views." I thought he was speaking of politics, until we arrived at Elizabeth Arden. He'd booked me in for a full day of beautification, and dropped me at the red door before I had time to protest. He took himself to Bond Street, and then to Harrods, while I was prodded and primped to within an inch of my life. My brows were plucked bare and drawn on with kohl. My upper lip and legs were waxed and buffed, and my lips stained the deepest red I'd ever seen. "How is this meant to please your mother?" I asked him at the end of the process. I felt naked with so much paint on. I wanted to hide behind my hands. "It's perfect. You're exquisite. She won't be able to resist you, don't you see? I'm worried. Not that she won't like me, but that it matters so much to you. The whole scenario." "Everything's going to be fine," he assured me. "You'll see." Off we went to Swiftston, the manor house where Mansfield's mother lived with her second husband, Colonel O'Hay. He was 15 years younger than she, and neither of the Markham boys had much patience with him. I found him plump and silent, whereas Mrs. O'Hay was plump and full of opinions about everything. When I tried to shake her hand, she accepted only the tips of my fingers. "Enchanté," she murmured, though she didn't seem remotely enchanted, and settled herself in the best chair to lecture me on the accomplishments of her prize-winning hounds. At that first tea, I couldn't stop imagining how Mansfield's mother would have reacted to me as I was the day I turned up at Cocky's door, with no coat at all, my hands chapped and blue, and my toes nearly frozen off. In Paris, and then Milan, Mansfield had taken me to the best couturiers. I had all the right clothes now, silk stockings, a fur stole, a diamond bracelet that slid up and down my arm like Bichon Singh's long ago Kara. Mansfield had been so generous. I thought he wanted to buy me beautiful things because they were beautiful. But now that I'd run the gauntlet of Elizabeth Arden and stood in his mother's jewel box of a parlour, I had to wonder if every gift had in fact been for her. "She can hardly think I'm a society type," I told him when we were alone in our room. He sat on the edge of the burnished-looking silk bedspread, while at a long vanity table I swatted roughly at the back of my shingle with a silver-handled brush. "What's the point of all this fuss? My poor eyebrows will never grow back." "Don't be cross, darling. It's only for a short while. And then we'll wear our old clothes again and have a lovely new life." "I feel like an imposter." "But you're not, don't you see? This isn't dressing up. You are elegant under everything." "And what if I wore my slacks and behaved like myself? Would she throw me out?" "Please be patient, Beryl. Mother isn't modern like you." I didn't want to quarrel, so I told Mansfield I would try. But in the end, the only way we could survive our time at Swiftston was to divide and conquer. Mansfield looked after his mother, and the chauffeur looked after me. I was driven to London for long excursions and taken round all the tourist haunts, London Bridge and Westminster Abbey and Big Ben. I saw the changing of the guard at Buckingham Palace, the red-suited sentries filing in and out as if they had cogs and wheels. Afterwards, I went to the cinema to see the Battle of the Somme, the projector and illusion of life transfixing me the way so much about London did. Electric lights and electric kettles, music streaming out onto Oxford Street from a Magnavox loudspeaker. But the film's images of war were terrible. Men crouched in ditches, cowering in pain and terror, that made me think of Arap Maina, hoping to God he hadn't died that way. I missed Ruta, and wished he could have been there beside me in the dark theatre, though undoubtedly he would have been just as waylaid by it all, or even more so. A few days later, Mansfield left his mother's side long enough to take me to Newmarket to look at a stallion. Mansfield thought we might want some new blood for our fresh start. "I want us to be true partners in this," he said. "We'll find land wherever you like, and stock our stables with the finest horses we can find. You'll show me everything. I want to learn it all, and to be a part of the big decisions." I was relieved to hear it. Our shared dream of a horse farm had cemented us from the beginning. But at Swiftston, under his mother's imperious gaze, I began to have my doubts. Her opinion seemed to matter far too much to him there. The spine went right out of him when she was around, almost as if she were a grand puppeteer, and he made only of cloth and string. But in Newmarket, he squeezed my hand hard as we moved towards the stables. Of course he wanted a new life in Kenya, just as much as I wanted Green Hills back. He meant to be his own man, to claim new territory, and to do it all with me by his side. Until that day, I would have to trust him, and myself too. Messenger Boy was a towering red roan, with a flaxen tail and mane, and a bright kind of fire whipping through him. He was the biggest stallion I'd ever seen, and one of the most beautiful. His dame, Fifinella, was a Derby and steeplechase winner. His father, Hurry On, was unbeaten, and one of the greatest sires of racehorses in the world. But though Mansfield and I were thrilled by him instantly, his trainer, Fred Darling, had a sobering story to tell.
"He's not going to make anything easy for you," Fred said. "I can't lie about that."
The full truth was, he'd put Fred in hospital once. Not long after that, he'd killed a groom, trapping him in the stable and attacking him with his powerful hoofs and teeth. It was murder. Pure and simple. If Messenger Boy had been a man, he would have got the chop for it. As it was, he'd been banned from racing in England. Kenya could give him a second chance, though.
"Can he be tamed?"
Mansfield wanted to know.
"That's hard to say. I wouldn't do it."
"I want to go at him," I said, watching the way the sun glinted flame red through the stud's flared nostrils.
"You're not afraid?" Mansfield asked, reaching for my hand.
"I am, but we can't leave him here to be chained up like a dog." For some reason, Messenger Boy made me think of Paddy, of the difficult line between wild, natural things and the civilized world. He's still got something good in him. Anyone can see that. Mansfield's hand clenched mine. I knew he was rattled by what we'd learned.
"Will he win derbies?"
"If Ruta were here, he would say, 'His legs are powerful as a leopard's,' or 'His heart is like a wildebeest's,'" I said, trying to lighten the mood.
All right, then. How much for leopard legs?
Mansfield said to Darling, drawing out his checkbook. Chapter 48. Dennis and Mansfield had never met. When we drove out to Borgarney on a bright, dry afternoon, just after we'd returned from England, I was a little out of breath, thinking about how they might size each other up. We'd brought back the new buttercup yellow Rolls-Royce. My dress was from Worth, my rope of pearls from Asprey. Perversely, I wanted both Dennis and Karen to see all of it, and me, to full advantage. I wasn't a waif any longer, or a child. But when we arrived, only Karen's majordomo, Farah, was on hand. "They are out walking, Sabu," he said cordially. "Up to Lamwia, to the site of their graves." "They're still very much alive," I said to Mansfield, when he gave me a curious look. "They're just overly romantic that way."
"That's fine," he said. "I love romance."
He opened the rear door, and the three dogs we'd been travelling with rolled out onto the lawn. A borzoi, a pretty red setter, and a young blue deerhound that we'd brought back as a gift for Karen. The dogs leaped and yelped, happy to be free, while I couldn't stop looking up into the hills, wondering if Karen and Dennis could see us, and when they'd come.
"You look well, Beryl,"
Dennis said later on the veranda. My dress had been crushed from sitting by then, and I was feeling tired and a little nervous at seeing him. He kissed me quickly.
"Congratulations."
Mansfield was a full head shorter, but so had Barclay been. I found myself hoping that Dennis saw what I did in Mansfield, and also what Mansfield saw in me.
"We went to the National Gallery," I said, feeling myself flush crimson, "and to the Bolshoi Ballet in Rome."
I was bursting to tell him all we'd done and how I was changed.
"How marvelous,"
he said several times, evenly, as I talked and talked.
"Good for you both."
But there was no real feeling behind his words. He seemed politely indifferent to everything. Karen was clearly taken with her new hound, which had rich grey eyes and a ruff of wiry whiskers around her long nose.
"She's delicious. You were a dear to think of me, especially since I've been lonely without Minerva."
Apparently, just the month before, the pretty house owl had flown into the wooden blinds and got tangled in the cords and strangled to death.
"We shouldn't care so much about animals," she said. "It's dangerous."
"I can tell you the animals aren't over-concerned about us," Dennis said, settling back into his chair.
"Of course they are,"
she countered, reaching for the hound's damp, soft muzzle.
"Minerva was awfully fond of me, and so are my dogs."
"We ring the dinner gong, and they run to us. That's common sense, not love. Not loyalty, either."
"He's in one of his black moods," she explained to us, as if he weren't there.
"Where are you off to next?" I asked Dennis, dying to change the subject.
"To Rejaf. I'm taking some clients down the Nile."
"How exotic," Mansfield said, drawing on his cigar.
"It sounds like a Hollywood film." "The mosquitoes would tell you otherwise."
"I've always wanted to see the Nile," I said.
"It's hardly a moving target," he said,
and then got up to see about something inside the house. Karen raised her eyebrows at me. "Black mood," her look said. But I felt slapped. I'd played out this encounter dozens of times on the ship back to Kenya, wondering how it would feel to see Dennis again now that my situation had changed. I was married, and altered in other ways, too. I very much meant to be happy, and wanted him to realize that. But he was behaving so oddly, and being cold to everyone. Nothing was going as planned.
You're going to